Thank you so much for tuning in today. You're here with Christina DeRocher and Paul Rattay, The Skeptical Naturopath. You're listening to Community Radio WDRT, and we're here to pick up the thread from last month. We have yet to address Paul's diet journey. It's quite an interesting one. There are many, many facets to your diet journey, Paul.
Twists and turns, cliffhangers, suspense builds, yes.
So where would you like to begin?
Let's just start at the beginning and go forward, right? Let's look chronologically at what I've done. So my story, you know, I remember in my college days going home and my mom was on the low-fat diet kick, right? So this is sort of the aspect, fat's a bad guy. This is, what, the mid-80s, mid to late 80s. And I remember this was the whole, I can't believe it's not butter, right? Getting used to eating alternatives to fat, right? Because fat's the bad guy. It's cardiovascular disease. And I guess I knew enough, or I knew, it's not like I studied this, but the sense was like, fat's a bad guy. We need to change this. So that was kind of my early introduction, kind of eating those baked potatoes made in the microwave with something sprinkled on it, right? Instead of, or putting salsa on potatoes too. That was another thing that I did. Anyways, I can go back earlier too, right? So I should comment on this. I think I've made a mention of my mother. I wonder if she's listening to this, right? Whether she remembers.
Hi, Mom.
Hi, Mom. Sorry if I'm hanging you out to dry. But, you know, my mom worked, so we fended for ourselves, right? So this is the trying to find what are we going to make, right? What are we going to cook? That's where Bisquick came in. I don't know if I talked about Bisquick before.
I don't think so.
But Bisquick, you remember Bisquick? There's like 8 recipes on the Bisquick package.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. There's biscuits. There's pancakes. There's pigs in a blanket. Those are the recipes. And it was Bisquick, so it was really easy. You just mix it with water or what have you and follow that. And, you know, I was raised on frozen pizza. I was raised on frozen broccoli. I was raised on, I don't know so much TV dinners. I always wanted TV dinners, but I never really got them.
Salisbury steak.
Salisbury steak.
I remember it fondly.
Dinty Moore beef stew was a big one, yes. Mm-hmm. Honey Nut Cheerios, which we've commented on. These were the things that were around me. And somewhere along the way, I decided, like, I can move beyond that. Like, I want to move beyond the frozen pizza. And that was using Bisquick. So I'm the oldest of 3, so oftentimes it was me, the one making the decision to say, so what are we going to eat? So I started making things from Bisquick, right? And I started to use, I made biscuits a lot, right? Biscuits actually became a carrier for Wilderness cherry pie filling. Do you remember the cherry pie filling or apple
pie
filling?
Right?
In the can, yes. Oh my goodness, glorious. You put that on a biscuit, now it's just, you know, total sugar bomb.
It's kind of like a cherry turnover without much to do.
Exactly. Yeah. So you make the biscuit and it's fresh and you put that on it, not so bad.
Right.
Anyway, so I came upon Bisquick and sort of took that upon myself to learn to make some things.
Which was fine because that's carbs, and so you're still...
For sure. For sure. Well, this is even before the fat thing.
This was just
like survival. Like, what are we going to eat? And how many Totino frozen pizzas am I going to eat?
Or oh
Steakums was another one. Do you remember
Steakums? I do, actually.
Those really thin little steaks that would fry up really quickly.
Right.
Spam. I don't know that we had so much Spam. I remember Spam every once in a while, but certainly the Dinty Moore beef stew was a go-to, right? And my mom certainly shopped the sales, and that was the thing. But, you know, bless her heart, there was no soda in our house. Never was there any pop or soda in our house.
Wow.
If that was something that we had to do that on our own.
Yeah.
And I remember I had braces in my high school years, and I remember I had the fear of God they were glued on, that you can't drink soda because the soda is going to dissolve the glue, and your braces are going to fall off.
Uh-huh.
Right, this is what my dentist, my orthodontist told me. I'm like, I can't drink soda. And it's not like I drank a lot of soda, but you could drink diet soda. So somehow diet soda was all right. It was whether it was the carbonation along with the sugar that was the problem.
Okay.
But sure enough,
I
had my braces fall off anyways, right? But maybe that was just a ploy to not get me to drink soda.
That's very smart.
What's interesting is that I actually drank diet soda there, right? And I never really drank soda before that, but then I started to be like, oh, I can drink diet soda. I don't know that I ever really liked it, but I could drink it. So it was sort of this other option that came out, but that never really stuck with me. Anyway, so that's, you know, maybe through high school, I leave the home, I come back, you know, I'm in college, I come back, I kind of get in, my mom's like not eating any fat, and I'm like, oh, okay, I can kind of do that. And I kind of went further with that. I actually decided, well, I'm going to follow the Pritikin diet. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Pritikin diet. It was a precursor to the Ornish diet. It's actually, I think what Ornish based his diet on was the Pritikin diet. And they had a Pritikin, he was a runner.
Didn't he have cans of soup that you could buy that was, or was that Ornish?
Perhaps, I don't remember. I remember there was one type of cheese that you could have on the Pritikin diet. I can't remember what it was, but it was a low fat cheese. It wasn't mozzarella or anything. But I mean, I must have gotten the book. I'm not sure how I did this without the book. And, you know, it would have been one of those Bantam paperbacks.
Right.
Remember the Bantam?
Yes.
So I did follow this, and very low fat. So it's sort of a big change. And I remember, I mean, it was during my college years somewhere along the way. Very low fat, 5%. I mean, the goal was 5% or less of calories as fat. Ornish actually was 10%. So Ornish actually loosened the purse strings a little bit.
For himself, but in his...
No. His diet's not as aggressive as the Pritikin diet was.
Okay.
And I think there was a Pritikin Longevity Center that was in Arizona, Phoenix or something. So, but very low fat. And I remember I could only eat meat once a week. So it wasn't vegan or vegetarian per se, but it was still staying away from the fat. And even you, I mean, theoretically, we could say, well, you could eat chicken breast, you could eat white fish, that's going to be low fat. And so the fat was the priority there. But it was meat once a week, right? So it was Sunday was chicken day, or at least that's what I determined, and that's the version that I chose. I don't know, I can't remember the book. Perhaps there were variations on a theme. And it was a problem, right? So I had chicken on Sundays, and I was fine through about half of Monday. Well, maybe Monday was all right, but Tuesday morning comes around. All I'm doing is thinking about chicken.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm like, when am I going to have chicken? Chicken, right? So it kind of builds up. It's this crescendo during the week, right? I'm okay Monday, but come Tuesday, now it's this gradual
ramping up
until Sunday comes, and then I eat chicken and I'm like, oh, and then I'm back to kind of what I was doing. Now, understand, it's also very low fat there, right? And I find personally what works for me is to have a higher fat diet.
Yeah.
Just higher fat is better to balance my energy.
Do you attribute that to being high metabolism or?
Perhaps, but I know people that are high metabolism that eat a lot of carbohydrates and they're okay with that too. I'm not sure, but okay. Whatever it is that the low fat, and I don't know that it was necessarily low protein. I was eating beans, but again, it would have been, you know, I'm not necessarily cooking all my food. I mean, I'm cooking things out of a can, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm eating chili or I'm doing something, I'm using cans to put that together because I'm no chef at that time, right? Not necessarily interested in that either. It was just a matter of, I need to follow this diet. Anyway, so it didn't last very long, right? I mean, I kind of knew pretty quickly, like, this isn't, I need to sort of balance that. But I wasn't really interested in nutrition, right? It was just a matter of, this is how I feel. And I still kind of, you know, I guess I held on to the low fat, but, you know, you kind of forget that. You just do whatever. But when I was deliberate about that, I it didn't necessarily work for me.
And that's very much your trip. Even back then, you said, I'm not really paying attention to the where's and why fors of the diet. I'm saying, how do I feel?
Yeah, how do I feel? And this idea that I'm eating chicken once a week and that's all I dream of for 5 days, that's kind of a problem.
Right.
Yeah. It's not working for me, right. Yes? So then I just go back to whatever it is so that I'm doing. And I'm not sure how long that lasted. But anyway, so that's that time. And then I graduate from college and then I went to Japan, right? I lived in Japan for, I don't know, 4 months. I went on a summer program after I graduated. So I'm 21, 22 years old. And I go there and, you know, I was in a homestay family for a period of time. And then I actually lived on my own for about a month, you know, maybe a month and a half or so. So I had to fend for myself. And so, you know, in that environment, somebody was cooking for me, right? I experienced what it was like to be in a Japanese family. but my diet changed. And it wasn't changing by choice. It was changing by I'm eating what other people are producing in a different country. Mm-hmm. And doing that, right, Japan, I would say that I ate very little, if any, dairy products.
Yeah, right.
I ate very little, if any, wheat. Right, so it wasn't bread, it was rice.
Rice.
Right, right? Mm-hmm. And it was rice, and it was vegetables, and it was fish, and it was chicken, and it was eggs. And these are the things that I remember. I mean, in my homestay, I ate what it was ever was there, whatever she made. But then when I'm on my own, I have to go to the market, mm-hmm. right? And I have no money. And so what am I going to buy? I mean, it was chicken, eggs, tofu, rice. I mean, that's what I ate. I remember I made chicken donburi, I think it was. Chicken and egg on rice.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I made that. I bet I ate that every day. Right?
Yeah.
And certainly if somebody was taking me out or I had the opportunity to eat sushi or raw fish, I did that at any chance that I had.
Right.
But still relatively expensive when it's compared to chicken and eggs and rice.
Right.
And tofu. And I remember just eating tofu straight up. Green onions on it, a little, you know, soy sauce on that, just slice it. I loved it. Loved it.
Yeah.
And it's still, I'm not sure that I don't know that I get that same tofu here. I've been told it's the water. I've been told lots of things, right? But I haven't, you know, I'm not any kind of tofu connoisseur, but I just remember eating it plain, right out of the package, loving it. And now, again, perhaps it's the ginger and the green onions and things that I put with it that kind
of... No, I think there is a difference.
Yeah.
Having eaten quite a bit of tofu in my macrobiotic days, and I think a lot of it has to do as well with how it's processed.
Yes,
and
correct.
So you're going to have artisans who process it correctly, so to speak, in Japan, as opposed to companies that, you know, basically they use methods that are going to take a lot of the vitality out of it, probably.
Right.
Just for business purposes.
And you can taste that.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can taste that, because I don't know that I've ever had that experience back here in the United States.
Well, and let's be honest. I mean, tofu itself doesn't have a very strong taste. And so how it's produced probably does, yeah, have a lot to do with how it ends up in the end. And that's kind of important when it's so mild of a food anyway. It's like,
oh, correct.
It better taste good.
Or
it's more like cardboard.
I don't know. How are we combining it, right? What's the texture? What's the flavor?
Yeah.
So that's my time in Japan. And the interesting thing is, I mean, I would say, you know, I've had certainly digestive issues in my life, right? Let's just call it irritable bowel syndrome. Never knew I had it, right? I mean,
In other words, you had symptoms, but you never had it diagnosed.
Alternating constipation, diarrhea, lots of bloating, GI distress, you know, this kind of thing, right? And understand that that's just that's my norm. I didn't know anything different. It wasn't so much that I went to a doctor. I said, oh, I have a problem. What's going on here? It's just like, well, that's just my digestive system. That's just how things work. That's just Paul.
Because it started when you were...
Oh, yeah. I'd been dealing with that my entire life.
Really?
Even as a young child?
Maybe
not so much the bloating per se, but I mean, I remember the constipation being a huge deal.
Right? Yeah.
And, you know, runs in the family. I mean, my mom's had that issue. I have that issue. It's just like, oh, well, that's normal,
so
right?
So she, too, isn't going to be rushing you off to a doctor because she's dealing with similar symptoms.
Exactly. And it's not like we're asking, so, Paul, how's your bowel movements? Right.
Right.
Which I do at home now.
Yeah, right. I was going to say, actually, my daughter and I talk about our bowels all the time. Yeah.
Completely different now. Like, we want to talk about poop, right? That's a good thing. Like, that's the most important thing that you're pooping every day, right? What's it look like and what's it smell like, right? Anyways, maybe I'm compensating for what I didn't have growing up.
Or maybe, I mean, yeah, but it seems like it's so natural in that sense. I mean, in other words, I would be concerned if Annalena was not concerned if something changed and she didn't come to me and say, hey, you know, what's going on? Something's changed. It seems so normal to me that it's hard to imagine that it's over the top.
Yes.
We know from, you know, there's the Chinese classic of Oriental medicine. That's one of the oldest medical books in history. Mm-hmm. And it, too, even goes into the color and the consistency of stool. I mean, this is thousands of years old, you know, so.
Yeah, so Chinese medicine, I think they have the 10 questions. My wife's an acupuncturist, so this is that they ask. And it's always, you know, the certain things that they want to know about, and certainly bowel movements and stool that are important, right? I mean, they're just other clues. It's just another barometer.
Right.
right? A barometer is just like, so how is it working? Is it not working? And then we just, again, either take it for granted or we don't take it for granted or we don't pay any attention to it until we perhaps have blood in our stool.
Well, and from your past, if it started so early, then the human being in general tends to acclimate and say, this is the norm. This is what, you know, this is what's been happening since quote unquote day one of my conscious memory of my bowels. And so you don't even, you know, it's not even a question then.
Right. Until you don't have the symptom any longer.
Which you didn't in Japan, I'm assuming.
Yes. So things change. And I'm like, wow.
I'm regular.
Is this how it's supposed to be? Really? Really? So, and I knew, right? I know I'm not eating what I eat in the United States. I'm eating in a survival mode, doing whatever I can, right? Not drinking alcohol. Alcohol was really expensive in Japan, right?
Yeah.
So this was a matter of, these are things that I wasn't doing. And I came back from Japan. I moved to Chicago, and I knew enough, right? I'm like, oh, I feel good. I just need to continue this. I'm not eating fast food, right? So it wasn't so much that I said, it's the dairy, it's the wheat, it's this kind of thing. It's just that I need to get away from what I thought the problem was in the United States, right? Which was fast food. I mean, you don't have to look very far on that. I remember like protesting against McDonald's. The Beyond Beef. I think it was called the Beyond Beef movement, right? Mm. The campaign.
Yeah.
We got signatures and we went outside of McDonald's, right? And I wasn't necessarily vegetarian, but it was, you know, McDonald's is a bad guy and they're a big part of the problem and we need to move beyond that, right? And maybe it was perhaps vegetarian in that, but I was more drawn to the, you know, let's get rid of the processed food or let's get rid of the fast foods, because that, I guess, was my experience. So I came back and I'd go to the salad bar. Yeah, so I'd go to the, you know, I'd go to the grocery store and get the fresh salad bar, and I knew enough that I'm not going to eat fast food any longer.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I completely took, you know, didn't eat it, but I mean, I was deliberate to say, I need to maintain how I'm feeling right now.
Right, right. Incentive.
My symptoms came back. And so that didn't necessarily cure that. So why was it? Was it because I was eating dairy, because I was back eating wheat? What was it? But certainly the eating none to eating some or a little bit or just getting the bagel on the salad bar or getting cheese on my salad, right? I wasn't necessarily, you know, paying attention to that.
And you were no longer living in that survival mode. Because when you say that too, I start to think also about probably even how much less you ate as well.
Perhaps, mm-hmm. And eating the same thing over and over and over and over. And I think that's part of the human experience, yes? I mean, we have availability of food, and are we going to change it up every day? It's like, oh, well, what's for dinner today versus what's for dinner tomorrow and the next day? And let's have some excitement at every meal, yes? Instead of like, boring, right? It's back to this boring diet. This is what you do. And then every once in a while, I mean, I remember in Japan that somebody they'd have gatherings, right? And so I'd be with other families and we have shabu-shabu. Shabu-shabu is kind of like fondue, but it basically is fondue, but you're putting vegetables in it and it's more certainly broth-based and not oil-based like the fondue here. But I just remember that it's completely social environment, yes? And understand, I'm not speaking Japanese. They know enough English, and it's just like this whole thing. And I'm like, wow, this is fantastic. And kind of like you could do that having fondue here, right, where you're around, and there's just this social engagement piece to that. But that would have been like the special holiday, or that would be instead of going out to eat somewhere, you'd be gathering with others and having this meal together.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I, again, it's not that we don't do that here, but somehow it's we're drawn to the restaurant, we're drawn to somebody else's doing the work for us instead of one family saying, oh, well, we're going to do shabu shabu this month and we're going to put it all together and we're going to go through the expense and the time. But then next month it's at somebody else's house. Yes. Yeah? So that was, again, just kind of a fabric of the culture that I was in. Now, understand it was also with other Americans that I was there with because it was a summer kind of immersion camp experience. Mm-hmm. Like we had classes, we were learning Japanese. So there were other Americans. and those families knew each other, right? So all these homestay families kind of were in, not cahoots, but they knew, right? So then we would get together and I'd, you know, see the other colleague, you know, my other colleagues or the other Americans there. So there was sort of, that was the gathering.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I reflect on that very fondly, right? But again, coming back to the United States, completely different story.
I'm going to stop you there to tell you thank you so much for tuning in to Community Radio WDRT. You're listening to Christina DeRocher and Paul Rattay, The Skeptical Naturopath.
Wow, we're halfway through, aren't we? And I've gotten nowhere. I just scratched the surface.
But the picture you're painting about your journey and how you came to conclusions, and especially, I mean, close to my heart, of course, is the Japanese culture of food.
Yes.
I'm wrapped with attention, but
yeah, and I'll speak to this. So I remember the one of the best experiences I had was, it was going to a restaurant, and it was in Osaka. I lived in Kyoto, and we'd gone to a baseball game. So the Osaka, I can't remember what their name is. So we went to a baseball game, and then we went to this place to eat, and it was, I guess the door was really low. Like, you had to get on your hands and knees to get through the door.
Oh, wow.
Amazing. And then it was almost like an auditorium, and there was the chef in the center, down in the middle, right? Auditorium in the round.
Wow.
And you sat at tables, and he was, and it was more than one, but they had the grill going down there, and he was cooking things. It was kind of like dim sum, I think you would say that, but it was certainly open, and you'd get like shrimp, and you just order little plates,
yes,
like dim sum.
Yes.
But I remember that experience and just being there. I'm like, oh my God. I mean, again, imprinted in my mind,
sure,
on that experience. I remember having a prawn, some barbecued prawn there. That was like the most amazing thing that I had ever eaten. Yes. So again, there's these experiences that I had, and again, still rather simple, because I remember eating sashimi. So just the fish, no rice, no,
mm-hmm,
the sashimi at a little place outside Osaka. So I had a friend that would take me there every once in a while. We'd just get a hunk of tuna.
Yeah.
And they'd slice it. And I'm sure we put wasabi and soy sauce. I can't even remember, but that would be it.
Just the raw fish.
Like melt in my mouth, and just like fantastic. And there's really not a lot of, you know, fat, salt, sweet with that.
Right.
Right? There's really not that. And just, I just remember those experiences, and I remember, you know, the flavor, the texture, of course, the ambience too, right? So it's just different.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, those are things that certainly stuck with me. I come back to the United States and I'm eating, you know, the salad bar.
Right.
It was sprayed with sulfites or, you know, whatever. And they're trying to present it, but it's still like all you can eat. Well, it's not all you can eat, but you get to choose, right? There's this choice thing here, right?
Yes.
Americans, like, we want to have the ability to choose what I eat for lunch and breakfast and dinner, instead of being like, well, here's what's available.
And no
here's
one,
how much money I have, and this is what my limited choices may be.
And no one would ever put, you know, no offense to the people working at soup and salad, you know, the salad bar, but no one would put them in the middle of an auditorium on display.
Oh, yes.
for the food production that they're creating in order to make this, right, salad bar. So it's a markedly different idea, right? Because the salad bar has its eye on the cheapest food for the,
yes,
for the most affordable but still the highest price in order to turn a profit. Nobody at a salad bar is saying, you know, I'm cooking this food with the most love, attention, you know, focus on health, right? It's just not about that. It's about profit.
Yeah, and the other thing in Japan is when you come into a restaurant, that they will like shout to you or say to you, and I don't know very much Japanese, but they say, Irashaimasu, right? So which means, I think it means welcome to our establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe I'm right or wrong about that, but they would say that. But you'd have the chef in the back or the cook in the back, and he'd like yell it out from where he was, like somebody comes in, it was like everybody would just kind of say that, like, welcome to our establishment. I mean, what a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
It's just
connectedness.
It's just this connectiveness, right? That we know, you know, Zippo here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyways, my experience in Japan, coming back to the United States, and then realizing, wow, things aren't quite that easy. Like, what is it? I mean, and then I start investigating more. And then the first book I wrote, I mean, then I start saying, well, I gotta like think about this, or I gotta research this.
Mm-hmm.
And the first book I bought was actually by a naturopath. I mean, I was working at a bookstore, B. Dalton's bookstore.
Oh, yes, B. Dalton's.
In the mall in Schaumburg at Woodfield Mall.
Oh, my gosh.
That's where I was.
I might have been there, actually, growing up in DeForest.
Shelving books there. Yeah. Anyways, so it was a book, you know, you buy books by the inch or something, right? And so they were all the older books. So it was Traditional Foods Are Your Best Medicine. And it's written by a naturopath. And I didn't even connect that, right? I didn't even realize it was just like, well, that's interesting. So it was Traditional Foods Are Your Best Medicine is Ronald Schmidt. He's a naturopath. He's since passed. He's out on the East Coast somewhere like Connecticut. But big Weston Price guy, right? So Weston Price was the dentist. I think we talked about that a little bit. That, you know, looking at the quality of the food that you're eating, right? Certainly fat-soluble vitamins and eating organ meats and, you know, this kind of thing. So then I read this book. I'm like, whoa, right? And a little bit about supplementation on there, but not so much the supplementation. Like, how are you going to do this with your food? And understand that Weston Price, that movement isn't necessarily dairy is an issue, right? Because it's raw milk. It's, you know, get higher quality.
What's the word?
Pasteurized.
No, where they make, you know, they make their own sour cream and they make their own. It's cultured.
Yeah,
right?
Culture.
You culture the foods.
You culture the foods. And this is the tradition. And this is what other cultures used to do, right? Mm-hmm. This is how we preserve foods. But for me, dairy is certainly an issue for me, right? So for me, it was dairy elimination that was a key component to that. So necessarily doing that, it was like, oh, we'll get raw milk, which I didn't really have a source for. I wasn't that enough resourceful when I did that. But anyways, I started getting interested and I read this book. You know, it was like, oh, eating organ meats and eating liver. And the funny thing is, I used to have my mom buy me liver when I was in high school. I would make liver sandwiches, I kid you not.
Huh.
And I didn't even realize that I could overcook liver. I mean, I suppose I figured that out somewhere, but I ate liver sandwiches and I'm sure I overcooked the liver.
Where did you even have the experience of liver to know to request it?
I don't know.
Interesting.
And I will say, though, that my family tradition at Easter was eating sautéed veal brains spread on toast.
Okay.
So veal brains.
Okay.
Now, again, that's what I grew up with. It's from my father's side, right? And that's the big family side. And that's what we would have. And I'm telling you, I still know what that tastes like to this day.
Sure.
And I like it.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure that I liked it at the time, but I certainly remember. And I mean, scrambled brains. It's basically what you're doing. Scrambling eggs, you're scrambling veal brain.
Wow. I mean, it sounds crazy, but going back to the indigenous understanding of the nutrients in organ meat, it makes perfect sense. And it also makes sense that you would have it at a special holiday gathering. This is not something that you would have access to every Sunday for your Sunday dinner.
Easter.
Mm-hmm.
Only Easter.
Right.
Anyways, I don't know if the liver came from that, but somehow, my mom would buy liver. Maybe we had it. I don't know that she actually cooked that. I'm trying to think if that was... I can't tell you, but I made liver sandwiches. I would saute it or I would cook it, and I'm sure I overcooked it, put ketchup on it, and make a sandwich with that. Anyway, so it wasn't too foreign for me to come back later and say, oh, well, there's health benefits to this, rather than I just kind of ate liver because maybe I liked it. So an easy sort of deal to say, oh, well, this makes sense to me and there's value to this and this is what other cultures used to eat and, you know, this kind of thing. And I get there, right? So amongst this is the dairy gets eliminated, right? That I completely am clear on dairy needs to be avoided in my diet. Wheat, I'm not so sure, right? I mean, I eat gluten, I eat wheat now. I don't eat that much. It seems that I tolerate that. And, you know, I certainly tell enough patients, I mean, if you've got any kind of digestive issues, in fact, you have any health issue, no gluten, no dairy, no soy.
Mm.
And maybe no eggs and maybe no corn, right? Those are close fourth and fifth. Maybe no nuts too. But anyways, I mean, that's just the standard elimination diet, right? If you've got a health problem, let's make sure you're not eating something that's contributing to that. Because again, of course, that's partly my story. And I figured out too that it's lactose intolerance for me as well. So I can, you know, take my lactase pill and go eat ice cream and I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm quote unquote cheating because for some reason I don't produce enough lactose or, you know, lactase in my digestive tract. And many Americans, many humans don't.
I mean, I'm biting my lip, of course, because in macrobiotics, one of the main dictums is no animal drinks milk after it's weaned.
Yes.
And it's considered a fun food. It's not verboten, but it's just considered, why would you take another animal's milk that's meant for its offspring in order to grow it at usually a rapid pace, right? I mean, you know, breast milk of any kind is meant for serious growth, right?
Yes.
During the first years. And so the idea that even a teenage human, let alone an adult finished growing human, would take on such a strong, you know, chi force, I guess.
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense. So as you're saying it the whole time, I'm like,
But let's talk about that too for a second. That's the geography. So if we're talking about Japan and we're talking about an ancient diet, we've got Japan, an island country, the size of California with, I don't know, 10 times as many people, probably more than that.
Right.
So they know how to live in that space, right? Yeah. They have a lot of land that they use. They're not raising dairy cows.
Right.
They're growing rice. So that's the prerogative there. So there's no cows. I mean, it's not that there's no cows there, but it's going to be very expensive. It's not part of the culture. They perhaps haven't adapted to it versus, you know, pastoral farmers in northern Africa or whatever that eventually adapt to say, oh, this is another alternative fuel source. And keep in mind, too, I don't have to kill the cow.
Right. Right. And also then my mind goes to their gut biome. And I say, okay, these are people that have been living in this area with the cows for a millennium, right? And they are eating, you know, they're taking in that food stuff for many, many generations.
And then so, they somehow adapt to that.
Right.
And interesting, so the microbiome is extremely important.
But I still would go back to how much are they really imbibing, right? I mean, I doubt that, I mean, the American commercials drink a glass of milk every day or three glasses of milk. You know, I wonder how much indigenous cultures take of dairy products in general.
Not here, not Native Americans.
Right.
We bring the cows over, but we also realize that this is a great environment to grow, to raise cows.
Mm-hmm.
It's very conducive to that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're introducing something to say this is not, quote unquote, the native diet, but this is what, you know, we're bringing along, right? We're bringing our culture. We're not going to adapt to the culture that's here already.
Right.
Yes.
And then
we change the environment too. I mean, certainly look at that, what we did with bringing disease over. Yes,
yeah,
I mean, indeed. These are all the aspects of now, you know, the mixing of cultures and mixing of traditions, and that's the, you know, the melting pot that we are. Yes, but regardless, whether dairy or not dairy, but dairy problem for me, and whether it's that I take my lactose pill now, interesting enough, butter's not an issue for me, right? So butter is not a problem, and I could get away with some goat milk is fine. Goat cheese, not a problem, but milk, cow's milk, an issue.
Yeah.
So that's sort of, I figure that out, and that's a big deal, right? That's a huge deal because has a direct gastrointestinal effect in me. So, but just by eliminating that and being strict on that made the biggest difference, bigger than me, you know, avoiding wheat or doing these kinds of things. So that's kind of that in-between phase, and then I kind of stumble upon the nutrition, and then stumbling upon the nutrition, then I stumble upon naturopathic medicine, and so that's another whole long story. But regardless, again, from B. Dalton's bookseller, right, not only did I find this book written by a naturopath that I didn't know was a naturopath, and I never even knew it was a naturopath, right, and didn't come back to it and say, oh, wow, you know that book was written? I didn't even know that until years later. But then I stumbled upon naturopathic medicine, and I'm like, oh, wow, wait a minute. There's like a profession that like does this, and they're trained, and they're doctors? And then, you know, I kind of ran with that because I'd always wanted to be a doctor when I was a little kid.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I remember second grade, what do you want to be when you grow up? I wrote this whole long thing. I don't know if it's long, whatever. Paragraph.
Long for you, perhaps.
Yeah, for
long
for
a second grade.
I want to be a doctor. I want to help people. So that's been well established with me. I remember one of my friends, his dad was a doctor, and he said, I want to be a doctor because I want to ride in an ambulance. Right? This is what I remember. And I'm like, I want to be a doctor because I want to help people. Anyways, but I got to high school chemistry. I'm like, nope, I'm not interested. This is nothing for me. I'm not doing pre-med. And I didn't do any pre-med. But then somehow I stumble upon naturopathic medicine. I'm like, the light bulb goes off. I'm like, what's this? And I contact naturopaths, right? I contacted a naturopath in Chicago and one in Twin Cities and talked to them. And I actually shadowed them and sat with them. I'm like, oh my God, I got to do this.
Wow.
But then it meant I got to go back and do all my pre-med too.
Yes.
So now I'm in community college taking chemistry and organic chemistry. And the funny thing is I didn't like chemistry when I was in high school, but when I came back to it, so even, I mean, I'm still, you know, 24, 20, somewhere in that age frame. I come back to that and I'm like, oh, I actually like it. I like chemistry. Nothing wrong with this. It was almost like I realized it was just a language rather than the truth.
Yeah,
it's a little bit more when I'm in high school. I'm like, well, this is the way of the world, and this is the way it works, and this is it, right? Like, this is passing judgment. Like, this is it. Like, chemistry is, we're the chemistry of life.
Yeah, yeah.
Versus now I looked at it and I said, oh, yeah, well, that's just one interpretation. So one way to look at that and one way to interpret that, and then to say, oh, yeah, it's just another way to see this existence. And I actually loved it.
And I wonder, too, if it was more... if it was easier to grasp because there was a practicality to it now.
Perhaps.
I'm interested in doing this because it's a means to, I mean, not that you wanted to overlook it or rush it, but just, oh yes, this is part of this process that I'm really interested in now.
Yeah, I'm not sure the actual going back to school was of a lot of interest to me. Mm. But once I was in it, and I think that I had a little bit different perspective to say, there's not just one way of looking at it, right? There was alternate viewpoints available. Because mm-hmm. just learning about naturopathic medicine, I'm like, well, wait a minute, you're a doctor, but you do this, but you don't do this, and this, you actually work with people, and this is a way to help people, and, you know, to empower people themselves, and, you know, whether it's supplements, whether it's diet, whether it's homeopathic medicine, but there's just other options that are available, right? So it opens that up, and I think that was just my perspective. I remember I had the instructor at the community college I went to, she was Indian, and she was just, it was just fascinating because she had that in, and it wasn't so much that it's like, what's the information? It's the delivery of that and getting you interested in that, right? So sort of that,
spark.
I became curious,
mm-hmm.
like curious on something that I would have told you a year earlier, 2 years earlier, oh my God, I want nothing to do with that, right? And I did nothing with that when I was an undergrad, right? Because organic chemistry was a weed out class.
Oh.
That's how the pre-med students, they take organic chemistry, and if you're not passing organic chemistry, there's a problem here, right? Med school's not happening, or, you know, sort of along those
right,
lines.
Right, right.
Anyway, so that was kind of my journey into getting to naturopathic school, and then I go to naturopathic school, and then now what am I going to do, right? So let's maybe say that time of taking out dairy, I'm going to call that a little bit of an elimination diet, yes?
Sure.
Granted, I don't think I, you know, specifically did a 30-day elimination, which is what I have patients do. But I did something along those lines, right? Something needed to be removed from my diet that was a problem. So I go to naturopathic school, and then it's about all about vegan, right? So this is the kind of the underlying philosophy there, right?
Really?
Oh, yeah, for sure. This is back in, you know, 93 is when I started medical school. So I was there 93 to 97.
Huh.
Definitely strong vegetarian, vegan kind of influence, yes? Or that's just what my classmates did, right? So it would have been, who are the people I'm hanging out with? What do they eat? And, you know, I know enough. I'm not eating dairy. I mean, I'm no nutrition expert. I don't know that anybody's necessarily... I don't even know what a nutrition expert is, right? I don't know that I'm...
Here we are, skeptical naturopath.
I mean, am I an expert, right? I don't know. I don't know what that means. Anyway.
But was the school also propagating vegetarianism?
Not necessarily, but it was just kind of like that's the culture.
Okay.
That's the culture there, right? So we have potlucks. And the potluck is you are definitely bringing something and you are labeling everything that's in that food.
Right.
Right? You're listing it on the label. And then, you know, somebody would bring something with dairy or something with, who brought that, right?
Oh.
There was kind of that sort of jive.
You were purists.
Come to that purist to say, yeah, this is the issue, right? The issue is we need to get rid of the meat. We need to be on a low-fat diet. That was, and again, I would say that's sort of the kind of the mainstream thought process on that, right? That fat's the bad guy, and meat, why are we eating meat? We shouldn't be eating animals, you know, this kind of thing. And keep in mind, there's that sort of philosophy, and with naturopathic medicine, you're in naturopathic medicine because something brought you there. either you were helped by it, you knew somebody. I mean, I teach at the chiropractic school. It's the same kind of thing, right? The chiropractic students, like, why are you here? Like, what was your influence? Oh, I saw a chiropractor. Totally changed my life.
Yeah.
This is what I want to do, right? Which is different than, I think, conventional medical school.
And so do you think the naturopathic students along with you are also having similar, I was raised in the 70s, I was raised in the 80s, I did the low fat, I did the, the packaged food. They're coming from a similar background from you as well.
I think so.
Looking for that great alternative.
Right. And I think that many of my classmates, I would say, had some experience with a naturopath, right? So that either they saw somebody or something happened that they're like, this made a big difference. Or maybe they changed their diet, like it would have been my perspective. I remember I didn't necessarily see somebody. And I remember I read a book, I can't remember the name of the book, before I started school. It was on homeopathy. And I knew nothing about homeopathy, nothing. I mean, I was going to school and I couldn't even tell you what homeopathy was.
I'm going to jump in really quick and thank the listeners again for tuning in to Community Radio WDRT. You're listening to Christina DeRocher and Paul Rattay, the Skeptical Naturopath.
How are we time?
That's 40. So we have
20. That's 40. We have 20 minutes.
Yeah. But don't lose your train here. Okay. So you were saying.
So there's certainly that philosophical perspective of the students that go to naturopathic school, I think, right?
Yes.
Maybe that's somewhat different now, because it's also not that I'm going into a profession that I'm going to be making six figures when I graduate just because I have a medical degree, right? I'm an ND, and I kind of think, oh, well, I'm doing this, and I'm doing what I believe in, and then people will just come and see me. Doesn't really work that way, right? You have to establish your own practice. You've got to figure things out. And that was not part of my perspective going to school. It was like, I need to do this because this is what I believe in.
Right.
Not, I'm going to pay back my student loan debt.
Right, right.
So that's different from conventional medicine. Conventional medicine, that's a system. They know what's going to happen. Very predictable.
Mm-hmm.
The certainty of your financial reimbursement when you graduate. Whereas in naturopathic school, not quite that way. Certainly because insurance, for the most part, does not cover naturopathic medicine. In a few states, it does. And then you can bill insurance, and that changes things. But otherwise...
Which states are those? I might be selling my house. Just
Connecticut, Washington, Oregon. I don't know what the status is in California right now.
Okay. West Coast and an East Coast.
Yes. Not around here. And right. But regardless, there's that sort of philosophical bent, right? There's that piece of why we're here. And very strong, right? Very strong... I have a passion to do this.
Ideology, some passion behind it.
That's why they're at school, right? I would definitely say my experience there was based upon that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just my colleagues, it's, vegan. So I became vegan, right? So I went the vegan route. And again, it was vegan, right? No dairy, no eggs. So that's out anyways.
But no meat.
But no meat.
Are you dreaming of chicken?
Yeah, well, so I wasn't necessarily dreaming of chicken the same way, and perhaps it was because I adapted to not having it at all, but I think what happened was my digestive system symptoms came back, right? Uh-huh. And I wasn't necessarily doing dairy. And I don't think it was to the same degree that it was with eating dairy, right? Not the same lactose intolerance. But still, I would say that I have picky... A persnickety digestive system, yes? Like, I have to be very, I don't even know particular, but I'm very aware of how things affect And to say, and, so for me, then it became bloating, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much this typical IBS, the constipation things that return, or those symptoms that return, but the bloating. I just remember,
are you eating?
Oh my gosh, I feel like a balloon, right? And I'm like constantly, and
A lot of wheat?
I was eating a lot of wheat, so I was eating things that were that I could eat, right? So this isn't a matter of being macrobiotic and I'm balancing my flavors and I'm balancing the season.
Right.
It's like, what can I eat?
Yes.
And what can I make? And
potato chips
exactly,
are fine. They're
right?
Vegan.
Exactly.
Oreos are technically vegan.
Exactly. And it's not that I was eating Oreos and doing that, right? I was... better than that, but I wasn't being deliberate about saying, how am I combining things?
Yes.
Right? Or how am I...
making a balance.
Exactly. And making sure that there's that's happening. I didn't do that.
That's one of macrobiotics. You know, that's the one thing that we quote unquote have against, and that's a very strong way of putting it, but have against the emotional vegans is what we call them. The ones who just don't want to eat this or that, but they don't give a lot of thought to what to do on the other end of that. Like you say, just how do you make balance with what quote unquote is left then? Because macrobiotics also really for the most part isn't, you know, is can be very vegan, but you got to do a heck of a lot of work if you're not going to eat.
Exactly. You know. So perhaps I was unemotional. I just did it because everybody else was doing it. And it was like, this is what I need to do. And this is what's healthy. And this is, I mean, it's not necessarily what I'm learning in school, but certainly there is that low fat sort of bent, the low fat, eat less meat kind of thing. And again, I just sort of go along with that and realize, like, I'm going to blow up. Like, I feel like a balloon. And then, I mean, I remember going to the clinic, right, because I see the students there, right?
Right.
And it was just like, I'm so bloated, and they'd give me carminatives. So carminatives are things that help reduce gas, like ginger, you know, caraway, you know, these kinds of things, anise. Those are things that act as, you know, sort of bitters, but not necessarily bitters, but the carminatives that kind of can help reduce that. And I remember trying those things and being like, oh my gosh, this just isn't working, right? This isn't helping me enough. I need to just figure this out. And it's not that I didn't keep some of those things. It's just that meat came back into the diet, right? And it was like, oh, I'm an apologetic meat eater, right?
Right.
I don't know that I was necessarily apologetic, but it just became that was just something that I don't necessarily have to eat it all the time, but I find that just helped balance things out.
Right.
So I'm maybe perhaps not so grain heavy, yes, and understand that I still think that there's this drive for how much protein I'm getting and where am I getting my protein from. And along the way as well, I understand that nuts are a problem for me. So peanut butter is off the table because I react to that, right? I'm sensitive to that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that to begin with. I have a kind of a delayed reaction to that.
Yeah.
So that was something that was, you know, I mean, honestly, I mean, I could eat peanut butter out of the jar, right? I mean, just peanut butter.
And I love
you don't
peanut
have to
butter.
Put anything, right?
Yes.
I don't need salt on it is good, but I don't need it. It doesn't need to be Jif.
Right.
I don't need Jif, right? I can, oh my God, it's just like heaven, but I'm going to get an aphthous ulcer, right? I'm going to get a canker sore if I do that.
Okay.
2 weeks later.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So now it's all a matter of, you know, risk benefit. Am I willing to eat this to say, well, potentially a mouth ulcer is going to happen and I don't like those. They're very painful. I can guarantee you if I eat a cashew or I eat an almond, my threshold is less. Peanuts, I have a little bit more tolerance, but I'm still not exactly sure where that is. So I'm playing Russian roulette if I eat peanut butter.
Right.
Like I could eat a scoop. Maybe I could eat a couple tablespoons on a banana. I'd be all right. But I still really don't do that because I don't like those aphthous ulcers.
Not worth it.
Not worth it. But anyway, so then I had to, you know, the diet gets modified. Yeah. So it's not so much that I, you know, I'm not eating poor quality. It's just that I'm not, you know, pigeonholing this and saying, I'm not eating this. I got to try to find the balance with eggs, with chicken, with beef, with whatever, right? And those are things that I find that by putting that in there, it just became better. And it wasn't so much that I can't eat wheat, right? Because I did that when I'm in school. I'm like, oh, it's a wheat issue. It's a wheat. This was kind of before gluten. And not that gluten wasn't an issue, but wheat was the really strong component, right?
And there were lots of books.
And I eliminated
wheat belly and
I eliminated wheat and that didn't really do it per se. And then I went to Ezekiel bread and I mean I ate Ezekiel bread. I mean I guess I still eat Ezekiel bread except my son and my wife can't eat Ezekiel bread. So it's kind of like, okay, well I could have Ezekiel bread. But I eat Ezekiel cereal. That's kind of my, that's the cereal piece, right? So I don't have to do the Honey Nut Cheerios. And I get the crunch.
Yes.
And it's really not even the sweetness. Anyways, I digress. So there is that aspect of, you know, being vegan for a period of time. I'm not sure how long I lasted, maybe a couple months.
Long enough to be bloated
to say I need to figure this out. And and you know, how many beans can I eat, right? And it still seems after all this time, some beans I just have no issue with and other beans, even though I eat a fair amount of beans, that I just can't tolerate very well.
Mm-hmm.
Lentils and kidney beans just are not my friend. But you give me a pinto bean, a black eyed pea, a black bean, I have no issues with those.
Chickpeas?
Chickpeas seem okay. Chickpeas are okay. Mm-hmm. But lentils, the kidney beans, right? They just kill me. And I think I still, after doing that all these years, I'm like, I just have to eat more of them and I'll adapt to them. It just doesn't seem to work that way. Because right. I can eat a lot of pinto beans and no GI distress.
Yeah.
You give me a kidney bean.
No dice.
No dice. Anyway, so there's that aspect to things. So that kind of lasted throughout naturopathic school, right? So I'm kind of, you know, I'm certainly cleaning up my diet, right? Eating higher quality. And again, I sort of knew that to begin with, you know, eating the organ meats, but I don't know that I was deliberately eating liver or doing these things while I was in school. It was still kind of trying to balance this, you know, the vegetarian aspect with the meat that I'm eating. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And being aware that, you know, wheat's probably not my friend, and eating more rice and eating, you know, that kind of thing. Plus, I lived in Japan. I mean, I can eat rice. Mm-hmm. I can eat rice, mm-hmm. breakfast, lunch, dinner, and sticky rice. Yeah. Right? I know how to make sticky rice, and I don't need to put anything on it, right? There's not. It's just the pure starch and that sticky that you get from that and steaming that.
Yeah.
Heaven. Yes, heaven. And again, I still, you know, so that's certainly refined. Yeah, there's... I eat Haiga rice. Did we talk about Haiga rice before?
Yes.
So Haiga, where they still has the German tag.
Right.
So that's like my punting, like, oh, but that's healthier rice. Well, it does have more fiber, right? And
yes.
I think it is. And I can get that, and I know how to cook it in a way that it's pretty similar, right? It's not white rice, but it's pretty close compared to the brown rice. But again, I'm in Japan. I eat white rice. I'm not eating brown rice when I'm in Japan.
Right. Only,
there's no brown rice.
There. Right. Only peasants ate that. So
correct.
After that, they wanted to be rich.
Yes.
Right.
So that's through school, right? And at the end, so right at the end of my naturopathic school, the book Eat Right for Your Blood Type came out.
Oh.
So by Peter Diadamo.
Okay.
And Peter Diadamo's a naturopath. His father's a naturopath, James Diadamo, which actually I think he had the blood type diet, or I can't remember, which was published earlier, just a small book. And Peter, his son, took it a step further. And really, so then it was your diet is based on your blood type.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you're a type O, you're more of a hunter-gatherer, you have a more, you know, vigilant immune system, you'll get sick, you'll get lots of inflammation, but you'll clear it quicker. You don't have a very tolerant immune system. A type AB is going to have the most tolerant immune system. They won't overreact, but they may, you know, they may be more susceptible to cancer. But anyways, there's this sort of this whole piece to say, you know, based on your blood type, that there's individual diets. Now, that very much appealed to me because I knew that there's not one diet fits all. Right, there's not one diet that everybody should follow. Right, I knew enough even just working with patients while I was in school. If you're talking diet, like, wow, you seem to be good on that, but not good on this. Or my own experience, right? I'm like, I have my best friend who's, you know, she's completely vegan and thriving on that, and I'm like, but I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband is like, I can't be vegan, right? I mean, he's eating. I mean, I could hang out with him, and we could, you know, have our carnivore excursions or what have you, because he wasn't doing that, right? So again, there's just that perspective and that experience to say there's not a one-size-fits-all diet. But anyways, that was somewhat appealing. He's a naturopath, comes out right when I'm graduating, and so I'm like, I like completely glommed onto that.
I got to do this.
And plus, when I looked up type O, because I'm a type O, I read the diet, I'm like, that's it. That fits for me.
It made
no
sense.
No dairy. Right, keeping wheat at a minimum, keeping the grains at the minimum, tends to do better on, you know, eating more meat, you know, this kind of thing. I'm like, wow, that's me. And then there's still some variation on that to say, oh, but then maybe somebody that's a different blood type would do better with something else. So it's not so much that I even followed the diet. It was that I kind of, it made sense to me. It fit my experience. And then I started to do that in practice. So when I started practice, I mean, basically, I practiced, I would say, constitutional homeopathy. I give people a remedy. I would give them oftentimes some kind of liver support. And I knew enough going to naturopathic school that it's the liver. Everybody needs to detox, and they need to clean up the liver, and the liver is a big problem for a lot of people. So that kind of stuck with me, that I'd give kind of basic liver support rather than necessarily giving a multivitamin or fish oil. And then I would give them blood type diet. So I would ask, well, what's your blood type? Oh, I don't know. Well, here you go. You can do the little test at home, and we can figure out your blood type. And once I know your blood type, then I'm going to prescribe this diet for you. And you're going to just follow it because it's written in a book. Just buy the book. And your type AB, just follow the AB diet.
Okay, so I'm actually going to stop you there because I think we have a few minutes left of the radio show, and this is kind of a cliffhanger. I'm so curious to hear how this worked out because I know that you're not practicing the blood type diet now, but I can't for the life of me, and I hope listeners out there are also piqued in their curiosity. I can't figure out why that wouldn't work. So let's leave it there until next month. Listeners, we would love to extend an opportunity to bring in any questions or topics that you would like to hear discussed here with Paul Ratay as the Skeptical Naturopath. So I would like Paul Ratay to give his email address, and you are welcome to reach out at any time between now and the next month. If we get it in time, then hopefully we can address your question or your idea for a topic.
Yeah, maybe we'll invite you to come on the air with us.
Ooh.
How about that? Yes.
Sounds fun.
So my email address is paul@paulratay.com. Pretty straightforward. paul@paulratte.com.
Okay. Well, thank you again, listeners, for tuning in to Community Radio, WDRT. This is Christina DeRocher and Paul Ratay, the Skeptical Naturopath, signing off until next month. We look forward to seeing you then.
Bye-bye.